All right, well, thanks, Nate, and thanks to all the organizers for inviting us out to this lovely place. Since every cool person has been giving Chalk Talks, I figure I had to step up. So I'll switch over to the slides in a little bit, but I wanted to start off with just a little bit of motivational material, and you can completely tune out of this if your only concern is studying muons, because the punchline is that I'll tell you about a muon missing momentum experiment with a beam, and you measure the muon's incoming energy, you measure its outgoing energy, and if there's a deficit, you can have sensitivity to interesting things. But I'll motivate things with the same line that everybody else draws. We saw it yesterday in Tom's talk. But if we really want to ask ourselves where dark matter could live, it could be anywhere in this really horrible parameter space where we have no a priori reason to think that it's in any of these different possible mass points. But if we want to really make some progress in the discovery effort, it helps with an organizing principle. And the one that I like to jump on is thermal origin. And I'll mean this in a pretty agnostic way. By thermal origin, I just mean that there was a time at some point in the early universe where the dark matter number density was set by the temperature, and it was relativistic. And that does a lot of really nice things for us, which we all know and love. First of all, it's UV insensitive, which you can think of as either a feature or a bug. It's a feature in the sense that I don't have to tell you about what was happening during inflation or baryogenesis in order to start the clock and tell you how the dark matter came to be populated. On the other hand, a discovery won't necessarily tell you what was going on during inflation or during baryogenesis, and so you don't have that connection which you might want to have. But I think of it as a feature. It's predictive. And I'll put a little asterisk there, because even if it's predictive, it doesn't mean that it's easy to test. But in the models where dark matter annihilates directly into the standard model, it's very predictive, in that there's a minimum coupling to us that determines whether or not this story makes any sense. And I think most importantly, it narrows the mass range down to something manageable. And I think Hugh had a version of this in his talk, where now we can have dark matter somewhere between 100 TeV up to the unitarity limit, where there's some wiggle room if you're willing to invoke some more elaborate model building. And I'll say maybe the tilde MeV scale. Since there's a small scale structure workshop going on, I will say that you might have warm dark matter all the way down to the KeV scale, but the model building's a little more challenging. But in between about the MeV and the 100 TeV scale, dark matter sort of walks and talks like standard model particles do in the early universe. We think of it as a particle and not as a field. We think about them as things that we can produce as quanta in accelerators. They can scatter. They do the things that we expect from other particles. And everybody gets to decide where we start calling things WIMPs. So I'll say that WIMPs are somewhere between a GeV and 100 TeV, and that down here we can talk about light-dark matter between the MeV and GeV scale. And there's something characteristically different about what we expect from light-dark matter compared to heavier stuff. So light-dark matter, if it's thermal, the first thing that we demand from it, it's got to be a singlet. Under the standard model, we would have produced it at LEP. It needs due forces, and they have to be renormalizable for. Sorry. Oh, then.
Sorry,
just have
a persistent cough.
Oh, no problem. So it needs new forces, and the forces have to correspond to models where we've extended the sector to be renormalizable. And intuitively, if we want something that involves a higher dimension interaction where the annihilation rate goes like G Fermi M chi, this works out to be about 10 to the minus 29 centimeters cubed per second normalized to dark matter at the GeV dark matter at the GeV scale, so this is too weak. And so in order to get around this, to get a thermal cross-section where this is in the neighborhood of 10 to the minus 26 centimeters cubed per second up to order one factors, we need something else. And so we can ask ourselves, what kinds of new forces can we have? The new forces also have to be singlets. So what new forces? The most basic question that we can ask is, who's heavier? Is it the dark matter? Or is it the mediator that enables thermal freeze out in the early universe? And so if we consider the case where the mediator is lighter, so where m chi is greater than mv, this is nice. So sigma v now goes like the coupling of the mediator to the dark matter to the fourth power over the dark matter mass, and it's not particularly predictive. It's predictive in the sense that if you could probe this coupling, there'd be some minimum value that you had to have, but it's not required, and that nothing that we could hope to measure, at least by exciting standard model particles, would give us any insight into whether or not this is what was setting the relic abundance. But we could also be living in the more predictive regime where the dark matter is lighter, where just on kinematic grounds, you're forced to annihilate into the standard model, where now sigma v goes like some mediator coupling to the dark matter, mediator coupling to the standard model, and some kinematic ratio. And now we're in business, because now no matter what else I assume here, I know that the dark matter coupling better be less than about 4 pi, and this thing is a number that's always less than 1. If we consider the dimensionless version of it. And so now there's just some minimum value of this thing that we can measure in an experiment that would tell us whether or not this was happening. It's robust and it's worth exploring all the possibilities that make this possible. The thing to keep in mind in distinguishing these scenarios is that here you usually have on the left side of this mediators that decay to standard model particles. And here, unless you're in the compressed region where you're right in between one dark matter mass and two dark matter mass units, you're generally decaying into dark matter. And so this motivates searches for particles that couple to us in some appreciable amount that then decay to invisible stuff. Okay, so what mediator options do we have?
More massive mediator.
Okay.
In that case, you will have a small branching ratio to the standard model, I guess, always. And
that's right.
So that'll be, what do you think about, like, is that going to be part of the so usually it's kind of assumed that it's like either invisible or visible. Mm-hmm. And people talk about visible, are they including the small branching ratio?
Mm-hmm. Usually they're not, because there's, in every case that I'm aware of, the dominant branching ratio tells you which strategy is better for discovery. If you had a signal, then you'd want to ask the follow-up question, do I have other complementary things that let me distinguish between different kinds of models? And so people do think about this, but usually you develop a technique that looks for visible or invisible, and then it tends to kind of suck for the other ones.
Okay, so and it's not a generically true statement that the visible searches are parametrically better, and even if you have to pay a branching ratio penalty, it would sometimes be the right way to go. Mm-hmm.
I don't want to make a super strong statement about that, but generally speaking, you want to go for one or the other. And then maybe as an afterthought, if you're lucky, you might have handles for the others. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. But now, since we've already agreed that dark matter in this mass range, if it's thermal, needs a new force, that new force has to correspond to some particle that's a standard model singlet, and we've got a few options. We have to mix it into the standard model somehow, and since we're dealing with renormalizable stuff, we want to have things that can couple to dimension 3 or smaller operators. And so we could have the lepton portal. We could have the Higgs portal, where in this case we're adding new right-handed neutrino or some fermion. We're adding a new scalar that connects us to the dark matter. We could have dark photon. This is something that people think a lot about. Or something related, we could just gauge a fifth force. So in this case, we have some new vector that couples to some combination of standard model quantum numbers, and the precise choice that you make determines which current this is. And we can step through the possibilities. So this one, it's hard to make thermal.
Gordon, just a quick question.
Yeah?
What if I wanted to move away from enforcing renormalizability and just, I don't know, wanted to go to an axion-type portal or something like this? Because it's just dimension 5. Mm-hmm. It's hard to make it thermally independent.
I think you would have to do additional model building, because in that case you'd need a small suppression scale. You'd have to mix it into something. And you would still need a fairly large coupling. That generically, if you write down a model like that, you'd want to have the couplings be large enough that you can really get a pretty large cross-section. I don't know of any simple models where you're only adding those particles. You're still imagining that you've integrated out some stuff in order to engineer that interaction.
Isn't that like very similar to vmu j mu standard model? I mean, just vmu is the mu of the axis.
Yeah, so... right, but then the complete UV model that you would write down would require you to add other stuff and then integrate it out.
Yeah.
So it is a possibility. Yeah. But then you have to think about how it mixes. Well,
how did the PQWW axiom work? You
mean the one that was ruled out a long time ago?
Yeah, the one that got ruled out right away. What were the things that it was coupling to? They got integrated out.
It wasn't the Chu-Higgs doublet. It was one of the goldstones of the Chu-Higgs, an extra goldstone.
I think that's the other part of the story, though, that for those models to work out, you usually, if you're thinking about minimality, you want to have an extended Higgs sector, too, because then it's easy to mix a pseudoscalar into an A-naught or something like that. So I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about that, but you can make very robust statements about what's going on here, and maybe we want to think a little bit more about the other ones. But
sorry,
I think... what's up?
So you are like... trying to look for freeze-out, like regular freeze-out.
Yeah, regular thermal freeze-out directly into standard model particles.
Okay, below a GeV.
Below a GeV.
Okay.
Yeah, mm-hmm. So in that case, I could have right-handed neutrinos be my dark matter, but it's not easy. It's not easy to have a thermal system, and certainly not one that's predictive where the couplings to us determine what the abundance is, so I'm not going to consider that. We could have something through the Higgs portal where you have dark matter talks to a new scalar field. There's some mixing with some mixing angle with the Higgs, and now you're going into standard model fermions, and it turns out that this one's just ruled out. It's not ruled out if you have the secluded case where you're annihilating into the scalars themselves, but in this case, you're paying some very sharp Yukawa squared penalty at this vertex. You need a big mixing angle, and then once you demand the right mixing angle to get freeze out, then rare meson decays start turning on, where this gives you some missing energy, and diagrams like this will contribute to B to K nu nu, and that rules you out pretty comprehensively because the mass splitting in the available phase space here allows you to produce B to K phi. It looks the same. It's really well measured. You're ruled out. For dark photons...
What if the mixing is not linear mixing, but you couple to two mediators?
If you couple to two mediators... then it looks more like this story, or you have to go to four particles in the final state, or you're at loop level.
Loop level. I mean, if it's a light enough particle, it's not obvious that you're getting killed by the.
But if it's at loop level, you would still have this, and this is. I mean, the point is that it isn't even close. It's like super ruler.
You still have the.
You still have a.
The B2K5
phi. B2K5. The phase changes.
The phase space changes, but it's still, it's still several orders of magnitude excluded.
Up to what mass does this work? Maybe that's part of it.
For this? About a few GeV.
A couple of GeV.
Yeah, because, I mean, that's the mass difference, basically, between the B and the K.
And so if the meteor is 5 GeV, what about the pulse rate would change?
You could do it virtually. If it's 5 GeV, not a whole lot changes. I mean, the degree to which you're excluded changes a little bit, but then this thing just becomes a virtual particle and you can still make the dark matter. And so that contributes to it. And that process is also ruled out, so I think that's morally similar to what you're suggesting.
Also, the upsilon, no? I mean, I think
it's not the only thing that constrains you, right? This is just the most in-your-face kind of thing, but there's also Higgs invisible width, there are other mesons, there, yeah.
Okay.
So the moral of this story is this is a sort of hard game to play. My point isn't to convince you that this is 100% excluded. I think that it's at least 99.9% for any sensible thing that you would think to write down first. For the dark photon, there's just lots of stuff.
When you said rule, that's what the requirement is, the dark
matter? The requirement is that this thing mediates the interaction that sets the relic abundance. So this is the diagram that determines the abundance and that the mediator is heavier than the dark matter. That's all. Sir?
No,
So here we've got lots of ideas to study the dark photon scenario, new direct detection ideas, new fixed target ideas, B factories, neutrino factories. So this is an active area of research. So I'm not going to discuss it. This is for other talks. But I think this is qualitatively a little different, at least in principle, because here we can just gauge a bunch of different U1s. We gauge a new U1, and that determines which current this thing is coupling to, and in principle, that gives us an opportunity to get around some of these issues or to think about new experiments where certain models will qualitatively be different than, say, dark photons. And for gauged U1s, we only have a few options to play with that are anomaly-free, and they're linear combinations. So we have B minus L, B minus 3 Li, Li minus Lj, and linear combinations that preserve anomaly cancellation. And most of these they're like dark photons in the sense that most of the experiments that constrain dark photons and most of the ways that we might think to look for them also apply in those cases because they have a coupling to the first generation. And the main exception is gauged mu minus tau among these. Yeah?
These are unscreened forces, no, at long distances. So I mean, it's not like they are falling. So that they're sharp, no, like.
Well, why would they be unscreened?
More,
they're broken.
They're more constrained.
No, they're broken. Right? Why would they be unscreened?
Which masses are in
You pick your favorite mass that gives you freeze out. We'll consider all possibilities. Yeah. If you make the dark photon massless and then you try to do freeze out, that would be ruled out too.
Yeah.
Right. Uh huh.
Favor indices, you're just saying that you use a favor singlet?
Sorry?
The mediator, there is a favor singlet?
The mediator is a flavor singlet, right. So all I mean is that here, you're gauging these quantum number combinations, and that determines which current you're putting here. So for example, if this is mu minus tau, you've got some mediator, and it couples to mu gamma mu minus tau gamma mu tau, right?
But in the effect, why do you want it to be a favor singlet? I mean, in principle.
You want to have flavor violating indices? Is that what you're suggesting?
I'm saying that. So, yeah. Why?
Oh, I think that if you were to allow yourself models where you had flavor violation at the tree level vertex,
yeah,
then you'd have a whole bunch of other constraints
too. Yeah,
no,
that's for sure. But I don't see this trial that you cannot put up more or less easily a model in which.
That's true. So, I mean, these are the U1s that I'm familiar with that are anomaly free. I think you might have to do additional model building.
You would always use magnetic abundance. You need to make the thing heavy.
It seems like that's a dangerous game to play.
Yeah,
I don't know of an easy way to do it.
Okay.
But so for the rest of the talk, I'll focus on gauged mu minus tau as the one exception to the fact that all these other possibilities at least give you, to leading order, things that are very similar to dark photons, and then you can use the ideas that people are already proposing. So any B minus L gauge boson will also scatter at sensei and semiconductors. You could make it in B factories. It couples to baryons. You could make it in a neutrino factory and hadronic interactions and so on. This one's conceptually different. Up to a small kinetic mixing that you engineer at loop level from integrating out mu and tau loops, this is qualitatively a different beast. And so in this scenario, we would also add V mu coupling to dark matter. And we want to let ourselves freely choose the coupling here because we don't have to assume that the dark matter has unit charge under the mu minus tau, it could have its own charge. And so the free parameters in this model are the overall gauge coupling to standard model particles, the gauge coupling to the dark matter, and the mass ratio of these things. And so that's what I'll consider from here on out. And we want to consider the most predictive scenario where you're annihilating directly into mu's, tau's, and to their neutrino flavors. And so that sets the pace for the rest of the talk, where I'll actually show you slides and results. So should I move the screen down, or?
Sorry, yeah, the kinetic mixing that's there, so you then apply all the other constraints coming from the your prime stuff, is that right?
Yeah, so.
And loop factor down?
Mm-hmm. They're loop factor down, but generally, I mean, the coupling, so the kinetic mixing will be the gauge coupling times, like, you know, 10 to the minus 2, and so those generally won't be very strong. They'll, okay. And so now how to look for these things. So one idea would be muon missing momentum. And so this is based on a recent paper with Yoni Khan, with Nyan Tran, and with Andrew Whitbeck. And it connects to other ideas involving missing momentum experiments in fixed target collisions. The basic idea is you've got some muon beam. It comes in with about 10 GeV of energy. And you want to do a couple of things. You want to first pass it through a tagging tracker to measure its incoming energy, because generally it's hard to have monoenergetic muons produced in any facility. So you have some spread of incoming energies, because you're getting these from pion decays. Once you've measured the energy, you pass it through a target. So the target is the blue box there that the arrow is pointing to. And this now can be some 50 plus radiation length material. We've considered tungsten. It's not an essential requirement. And the idea is that if you produce dark matter in any of these collisions, it'll take away a large fraction of the incoming beam energy. And so what you'll observe on the other side of the target as it passes through the recoil tracker is that the muon that comes out has just lost a lot of energy as it passed through the target. And there are very few standard model backgrounds to this, as we'll see. But the basic idea is that you're just emitting radiatively one of the gauge bosons, a mu minus tau gauge boson, or you can think of it as any muonic force. And that gives you some missing energy. The downstream Ecal and Hcal are there to make sure that you're not mysteriously producing standard model particles that you somehow miss and convince yourself that you've emitted a signal event.
You really need both Ecal and Hcal.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, if you make something hadronic, you make a bunch of neutrons, you want the Hcal there to stop that. The Ecal is usually pretty simple. You might get away with a fairly thick Hcal. But both of them are nice. It's also that there's an existing literature on having both the HCal and ECal combination from LDMX, where you use an electron beam instead of a muon beam. And they're just Jeon simulations that tell you what you expect and what your backgrounds ought to be. And a lot of those results will apply in the case that we have here. Yeah?
Is that some reason why you need to put the recoil tracker between the target and the ECal, and then, like, other place, like between ECal and HCal?
Mainly because we want to be able to get the muon right after it interacts. So if we were to put the recoil tracker on the other side, then the muon would go through a lot of extra material. You want it to go through a specific amount of material. If it's too little, you don't have as much effective luminosity. And if it's too large, then the muon loses a lot of energy just from multiple scattering off of targets. And then you might fake a signal just from the fact that it's moved through a lot of material. And so there's a sweet spot, and that sets the active target region. And then the ECAL can just do whatever it wants. You can make the ECAL really big, because at that point you've already isolated the things that you're looking for.
I'm sure you're going to come to this, but just roughly, how big is the coupling?
Anywhere between maybe about 10 to the minus 4 to 10 to the minus 6, 7. That's the ballpark.
That's actually in the blue region there.
Which blue region?
Active region, I think.
The active region, so this is just a hunk of tungsten. It's a hunk of tungsten with PMT, so it's an active target. And so if a muon passes through this and, say, gives you a hard Bremsstrahlung photon, which might count as a background if you miss that photon, the active target lights up and you veto that. Or if you make a bunch of hadrons and you notice some other energy depositions, it just makes your life easier.
Okay.
You can just reject it, because the signal event, as we'll see in some plots down the road, looks like a muon just passed through and deposited less than 100 MeV of energy just from regular minimum ionization. But it still ends up with a highly curved track, because this is all in a magnetic field, and they're emitting the signal particle is the only reduction in its energy, at least by some order one amount that defines your signal requirement.
So your observable is going to be missing transverse energy?
Not necessarily transverse. I mean, what we'll want, we just make a requirement on the momentum, say, right? We measure the momentum coming in, and then based on the curvature of the track, we can just reconstruct what the outgoing momentum is and impose a requirement on that.
I see. Sorry, but you're tagging things that have missing energy or momentum, whatever you want to call it, on the other side?
We're only looking at the muon.
Really?
Muon goes in, muon goes out, and the incoming muon, say, had 15 GeV. The outgoing muon has 6 GeV, and we say that's a signal candidate.
And why do you need all the rest of the detector?
Because if you make a bunch of standard model stuff and you miss it, you'll think that you made dark matter.
That's just kidding.
It's literally just a veto. That's the only thing it's
doing. And you are using the rest of the detector to measure something.
But we're not looking for missing energy per se. The detector here is not there to measure the missing energy directly. It's just to say, if there's other standard model stuff, we reject it.
It sounds like you are looking for a muon with nothing recoiling against it in the transverse direction.
That's correct.
So I would call that you're looking for missing energy.
Okay, fair enough. Okay, fair enough. Missing energy and or momentum. Mm-hmm. But yeah, we absolutely do need the other stuff. I agree. Okay. And so, we measure the incoming energy. We trigger on it. We veto standard model activity. It's perfect. Very informative slide. Yeah. We demand that the outgoing energy is less than half of the incoming. I'll forgive you.
You have to measure something to trigger on it.
Yes, we do. Okay. I think this slide is fairly self-explanatory. The thing to worry about are backgrounds. And so you might have the production of standard model particles in any number of places, anywhere inside the target. If you observe activity in the target, that's easy. You just throw it away. If you observe something in the ECAL, you throw it away. You observe something in the HCAL, you throw it away. If the muon just passes through and doesn't lose a lot of its energy, you reject that. So we're really looking for some very specific kinds of events. And we have in mind a two-phase project at Fermilab. So one involves the M-test and M-center. So
how much energy loss are you looking for?
The specific amount doesn't really matter that much, as long as it's, say, 40% of the beam, could be 60% of the beam, but like many tens of percent.
Okay. Is that driven experimentally?
Yeah.
And you don't have resolution?
It's mostly the backgrounds, because if we only demanded, say, like a 1 or 2% reduction in the energy, then that's pretty easy to fake. So it's because of resolution, it's because you'll just lose some energy passing through the material and so on.
I mean, what does that energy loss distribution look like? There's some fraction of muon.
I will show you a plot. I'll show you. So this is the nice thing. So two of my collaborators are Nyan Tran and Andrew Whitbeck. They're experimentalists, and they did a Jeon simulation for us. So we have a lovely plot of that. So I'll hold on to your question for a little bit. But the basic idea is that we want to do this either at the M-test center, where it's easier to set things up, but we don't get as many muons. So there, phase one would involve about 10 to the 10 muons, run for about a few months, and you get about 10 to the 5 muons per spill. And it turns out that you actually can separate out the muons almost individually if the timing in your ECAL and HCAL is sufficient, because then the RMS time separation between individual muons is in the like few to tens of nanoseconds. And so you actually do get the opportunity to measure them one by one or few by few, as long as you're isolating their tracks and demanding that each track individually satisfies your overall signal requirements. So this would be like a pilot version of the experiment that's mostly designed to test the G minus 2 anomaly. Because another thing that gauge mu minus tau does for you is that it allows you to use new physics below the GeV scale to still viably explain why there's a 3.5 sigma anomaly in muon G minus 2.
No.
The beam is about 15 GeV.
The protons are
120 GeV. They smack a target. They give you pions. The pions decay. They give you muons.
I thought this is all coming after the one.
Everything starts
about
120.
That's right. Yeah.
Can you tell me again the coupling that you have in mind for to muons?
Somewhere between 10 to the minus 3 and 10 to the minus 6, 7, something like that.
So you do measure the incoming energy of the muons, like right in the beginning?
That's right.
Mm-hmm. So every muon that you're looking for, you know its initial and final. Like you can track muon by muon?
That's right, yeah. Because you're just passing it through tracking layers. They give you some minimum ionization deposition in each of those. You can usually get that to within a couple of percent in space and in energy resolution. And that's all you need, because we're really requiring something pretty in your face for the signal itself. So you want to lose many tens of percent of your incoming energy, and your resolution's not going to cause problems for you there.
And you probably said that. What's typical muon energy coming into the detector?
So there's a spread, but the benchmark number is 15 GeV.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
You can tune it to some extent, but these are coming from pion decay, so you can't really be that precise about it. You can tune it within some spread. You can tune, the pions are, that's right.
So how are you tuning them? It comes from a beam that you hit against the wall, no?
Right, then you can just run them through magnets to pick out the ones.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm. How do you differentiate this from some of the photons like Maxim and Yiming? That was also a missing momentum experiment.
Well, but this is a beam dump experiment. So there, it's not about instrumenting the actual interaction point. It's about sending a muon beam into some fixed target and then looking for things that are produced and that live long past that target that then give you visible signatures downstream.
They could do invisible too, if I'm not
wrong. They do, right? So you have some... Pardon?
I think that there is a plotting out paper showed up on first.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I'll get to some plots later on, but the phase one is the more modest version. Yeah, sir?
One more question.
Yeah.
How many muons on target?
About 10 to the 10 for this one.
10 to the 10.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And for the more ambitious version of it, we would take the Sequest beam line, where we're just getting more protons so we can get more muons, we could run for longer. This is the phase where it would actually be a dedicated experiment. Where we're now shooting for 10 to the 13 muons. Okay, and so I'll say a little bit about the signal itself. And so here, if you take the coupling, here we're agnostic about, say, whether the particle you're producing is a vector or a scalar. If it's gauge mu minus tau, we want it to be a vector, but it doesn't have to be. So here it's 10 to the minus 4 coupling. The beam is 15 GeV. We're passing it through 50 radiation lengths of material, and we're taking 10 to the 13 muons on target. And so you actually get quite a few signal events for most of the mass range that we care about. And this was based on a very nice NADGRAPH hack from Yiming, who was very kind to share it with us.
And this is the recoil, 9 GeV is in the transverse direction, or that's the energy of the...
This is the energy of the outgoing muon. We're demanding that it be less than that.
And you don't require anything else, like you veto against the...
This is just the signal, yeah. How many events you're getting, and then we'll... But this is the signal subject to the requirement that we have that 9 GeV cut, yeah?
Is it truly just like with couplings to electrons that below an MeV you're hosed by CMB and effective constraints?
So I'll get to that in a little bit, but yeah. So for the dark matter, what you generally want is that, if depending on the spin of the dark matter, how many degrees of freedom you have, if you're demanding freeze-out, you have this huge entropy in the dark sector, and then freeze-out's happening, you know, at M over 10 or M over 20 in this mass range, and then you want to make sure that entropy is transferred before the neutrinos decouple. In this case, it's a little bit different from what you would normally expect with dark photons, because there the energy deposition is primarily visible. In this case, it's primarily invisible because you're going to neutrinos with some small branching indivisible stuff. But in both cases, you modify an effective in going in two different directions, right? So if I annihilate the neutrinos, then it's actually more dangerous. So I have an increased delta and effective that's hard to compensate. Whereas if I'm annihilating the photons, the surprising issue about that constraint is that now you're decreasing delta and effective. And so you could, in principle, although it's hard to play this game, you could compensate for that by adding dark radiation unrelated to what's happening with freeze-out. But in both cases, the punchline is basically the same, that a few MeV, depending on whether you're a complex scalar or whether you're a fermion, you encounter that wall. So here, this is just to give you an idea of how the signal changes as you vary the mass of the particle that's being emitted radiatively. So here, this is percentage of events and some binning, and we'll notice that the typical recoil energy is a fraction of the beam energy, tends to peak for very high masses on the lower end. And this is pretty distinguishable from standard model stuff. In principle, it's also distinguishable from Bremsstrahlung, where if you radiate a hard photon, tend to have events that are very forward peaked.
Do you have plots for Bremsstrahlung?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So here we're looking at what happens as you change the cut requirement. So this is how we're defining the signal for different particles and how much of a rate penalty that gives us on the y-axis. Complementary information to the previous slide, if I make my cut, say, 50% of the beam energy, I'm not really taking anything out of my one GeV particle that's being emitted, but I'm probably taking about a third of the signal away from a 10 MeV emission. So the punchline is that the precise cut that you impose doesn't make that big of a difference.
Energy is a muon lose just going through all the material. You get a lot of material.
That's right. The answer is about possibly in the hundreds of MeV, but we have a plot later that I'll show you. But I'll say a few things about backgrounds first. So the irreducible background comes from things that are generally G-Fermi suppressed. The big picture here is that these tend not to matter because the forces that we're shooting for, forces that are relevant for thermal freeze-out, have to be stronger than electroweak. And so anything that involves a G-Fermi is quite a bit suppressed. And so here, one possible background is that the muon scatters an electron instead of a nucleus in the target. It upscatters the electron to several GeV so that the outgoing muon looks like what you would expect for your signal. And then the electron undergoes a charged current conversion where it eats a proton and it gives you a neutron and neutrino. So that's a purely invisible final state. But the good news is that that scales like G-Fermi, and there's some geometric factors. It depends a little bit on your cut energy, but not that much. But the punchline is that you should expect less than one, and the probability of this to be less than one part in 10 to the 14 for incident muons. And even the most ambitious version of this idea that we have in mind could only give you about 10 to the 13 muons. So that's not a big deal. So we're going to say that's negligible, and that's also the conclusion that you would reach if you were just considering neutrino emission off of virtual Zs.
Just the efficiency for detecting the electron?
Here you don't detect the electron. The electron converts. So you're still looking at the muon. You're doing exactly the same thing, but inside the target, the electron takes away a lot of energy from the muon, and then it converts, and that's just missing.
Forget that process. If you just have some efficiency for detecting the electron.
That's true.
If you don't detect it, it looks like you're signaling.
That's right.
And that's the probability to not is way bigger than 10 to the minus 15.
No, that's right. So, but then it depends a lot on that's a lot, that's reducible. This is a slide only about the irreducible backgrounds.
It's, oh, God, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I'm a physicist.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I agree. That's what you should be worried about.
Yeah, absolutely. I just want to convince you that, like, there's no in-your-face showstopper for this. But, yes, of course, you have to worry about vetoing those, and you have to do simulation.
Veto, that's knowing how often that happens, because that will happen.
That'll happen. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It won't be that uncommon.
I agree.
Then you can cover up the gap for, you know, turn you can probably change the geometry a little bit to get a handle on that.
You cannot build a detector that is efficiency 100%.
No, that's right. That's
epsilon,
right.
Where epsilon is a kind
of for sure, but you can. But you can change the geometry somehow to get a handle.
So whatever you change the detector, whatever you do, those there's some efficiency to not, there's some probability to not detect.
That's right, but I mean, if you're passing an electron through some thickness of material that you get to choose, the probability of missing that per additional unit thickness falls exponentially.
It's a quantitative, depends how many tracking layers you have.
I agree. Yeah, so if we're talking about stuff that's, say, on the order of a radiation length, I would worry, because that's roughly the length scale at which you would expect electrons to lose an order one fraction of their energy moving through matter. But if now we're talking about hundreds of radiation lengths, and you've got an Ecal and you've got an Hcal, then that's a significantly reducible background.
I think that's a serious background. Just not detect.
I totally agree that these are backgrounds, but from the Jeant simulations that we did, that deposition...
It's a detector question.
Yeah, I agree.
It's how efficient the track you're detecting elements. Mm-hmm. They're not 100% efficient.
I agree, they're not 100%.
Not even close to 100%.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that's guaranteed, but... Do you have the simulation results? I mean, what are they?
Yeah, so I'll show you some simulation results in a bit. So another possible background that you might have is something like muon trident. So this is a reducible process where you emit two muons in a scatter off of a nucleus, and then the same sign ones pair up, and they have comparable kinematics to within what your detector can resolve, and then you fail to veto the third muon. The good news for this is that even if you don't do anything else, the fact that the two outgoing muons walk and talk like a charge two particle, they'll leave a different kind of charge deposition profile moving through the tracking material, and so you could in principle tell that you have two and not one, and that's something to veto on. But the better news for this is that if you just ask as a function of the recoil cut that I'm demanding on this, for typical choices of, say, energy resolution and angular resolution, how many events would I expect per incoming muon? The probabilities are in the 10 to the minus 10 level or so. So for reasonable choices, the phase one version of this experiment could be free of this particular background, but for phase two, this is something that would have to be more aggressively challenged. Another reducible background would be that you radiate a hard Bremsstrahlung photon. It initiates a hadronic shower, and then you have Ecal and Hcal systems that you want to use to veto these. One piece of good news relative to electron beams is that now you get a suppression of Me over Mu squared just in terms of the probability of emitting a Bremsstrahlung photon. So that's good news. But in the end, this is still something to worry about. So here's a quick rundown of different processes that we would worry about. For an incoming muon, we'll typically get one part in about 10 to the 3 that gives you a sufficiently hard Bremsstrahlung photon subject to the 9 GeV cut. Then that photon with some additional probabilities can give you hadrons, or it can give you additional muons or things that you might want to veto. And that imposes different veto inefficiency requirements. So the numbers in the last two columns here characterize how badly your vetoes would have to perform in order for this background to matter, for it to not be a clean experiment. And the probabilities here really are the product of all the other things that are happening in the event. So for example, if we're talking about a Bremsstrahlung-initiated event that produces three neutrons, for the more aggressive version of that experiment, phase two, these events would have to be vetoed with something like 10 to the minus 3 inefficiencies. But that means that your neutron inefficiency could be something as low as, say, one part in 10 to the minus 1 or 10 to the minus 2, because in order for this to actually fake your background, you'd have to miss all three of them. So if you can veto on any one of them, then that's fine. And then you get down to the irreducible floors, which are typically at the 10 to the minus 15 level. So the electron stuff is something that we looked at when we were thinking about electron beams in LDMX. And in that case, we found it to be negligible. This is something that we can scale fairly straightforwardly. I don't have the numbers on this plot, though. I thought I did on this one. But we can take this offline. I can show you a list that we have. Hmm? We did absolutely
consider to the photon, right? In terms of detectability problems, it's just a matter of getting to like not enough scintillation in the eCal, right?
Right, but I mean,
we're, you have to get the same kind of rejection for the electron process. I don't know how hard that is, but
that's right. It is.
You get the photon rejection at that level, I'd expect you to also get the
electron
rejection.
Yeah, I think electron would be easier.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
But yeah, absolutely. Like the photon is by far the hardest one. That has to be rejected at a much more aggressive level. But here's the result of the Géant study. So here we're passing 15 GeV muons. This was for a 40 radiation length target. So on the left, we're looking at how much energy is deposited in the target as a function of the recoiling muon's momentum. And the thing to note is that, so this is a log scale in color, and this is where, by orders of magnitude, almost all the events end up. So this is for standard model. And then you'll notice the difference in the scaling of x and y axes. So here we've got hundreds of MeV of deposition in even the most significant band of this, and we're looking at it as a function of the recoiling muon. So our signal only starts after we demand the muons have less than, say, 9 or 8 GeV of energy. And here what we're looking at are the momentum of the secondaries as a function of how much energy has been deposited in the target. So these are any other things that you might make from standard model particles. Running Géant for 10 to the 7 electrons, or, well, sorry, 10 to the 7 muons in the simulation. And the signal region that we have in mind is right down here, where for that simulation nothing was populated. So it seems fairly clean. This isn't a proof that it would be cleaner when you scaled it up, but it's enough to suggest that this idea isn't crazy and that it's something that can be done with a little bit extra work.
So at what level are you rejecting the Bremsstrahl and photons?
Here it's rejected at the level of about 10 to the 8.
And that's some simulation of the electromagnetic shower in the eCal?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's like a full detector
simulation. It's a full detector simulation, Géant. The geometry is implemented based on the cartoon that I showed you, and it's based on real-world design parameters for the LDMX detector as a prototype. It doesn't have to be LDMX, but that's something that people already have done some work towards, and so we're taking advantage of that.
So it was at least one part 10 to the 8.
That's right.
Should there be, like, an analog of the signal region in the left plot? Like, is there...
Right, so, but the signal region is just a hard cut on the muon. So the signal region would be, say, if we demanded 9 GeV, it would be sort of this into the left.
Well, the thing on the right is the thing on the left plus those requirements.
No, so the thing on the right is the momentum of the secondary. So these are all the other particles. Yeah, that's right. This is what we're trying to veto on, and we found a region where it seems fairly easy to do that. Whereas on the right, the plot on the left should convince you that as the muon moves through the material, it doesn't just on its own accord lose 9 GeV of energy without depositing something that you might be able to see.
Mm-hmm. Your point is that, so when you ran your 10 to the 7 muons, there were no events that came up with very little secondary momentum and the right amount of target energy loss to the target.
Exactly.
So that's where you would look for events to appear.
That's correct. Yeah.
Why not
10 to 7? Because it takes a long time to run Géant with this configuration.
How concerned are you for the other 8 orders of magnitude?
I mean, very concerned, right?
Yeah, you might instantly calculate that small box.
That's right. So that's the next step.
Yeah, because you won't generate enough Monte Carlo to tell that.
Well, so, I mean, then you focus on that phase space, and then you generate it, and then you divide out the acceptance for that part of the phase space, so you can convince yourself that you're getting towards that. But yeah, I'm not here to tell you that we simulated 10 to the 13 muons, just that, similar ideas have succeeded, or have, like, at least passed much more non-trivial checks involving electron beams, and that there are several advantages to using muon beams that should lead us to think that this is actually an easier problem, not a harder problem. It's harder to get the beam, it's harder to get the right number of beam particles to do something interesting, but the background rejection side of the story is actually simpler.
I'm trying to think, I can't come up with one. Is there any way to validate that in data
somewhere? There is. So one thing that you could do is exploit the fact that the recoil of the muon. So I don't have a plot of the Bremsstrahlung in this set of slides, but one thing you might worry about is, say, how the kinematics of the muon differ in the case of emitting a massive radiated particle versus a photon, right? And if you're primarily worried about Bremsstrahlung and missing Bremsstrahlung, you could look at the PT distribution, which I don't also have, but based on the angle of the outgoing muon, you tend to get much more of an angular deflection if you're emitting a massive final state than if you're just emitting Bremsstrahlung, because Bremsstrahlung is very forward peaked. And so if you could reconstruct the angular information from that, you could convince yourself that none of the signal is populated in regions of the phase space where the muon doesn't deflect a certain amount.
I wasn't worried about the signal. I was more worried
about it. No, but that's what I'm saying, that you can live in a region where if, or maybe drawing it would help make the point.
I mean, for hard Bremsstrahlung, it won't be that forward, right?
It's still considerably much more peaked. Or sorry, much more forward peaked.
Compared to isotropic.
Right. So, well, not just compared to isotropic, but one thing that I'll try to reconstruct just from what I remember is if you look at the PT of a particle as a function of the recoil energy over the beam energy, right? If you're looking at, you know, some choice of, I don't know, the MV of, you know, 100 MeV, right? And you do a Monte Carlo study of what, how you should populate this plane, you tend to populate events up here. And this is the PT of the outgoing muon, or the electron, depending on which beam you're using. And now if you're doing Bremsstrahlung, what you're really doing is populating this region here. Right, and so if I run some sample experiment, and then I only look in the region where my PTs are below some threshold, right? Here I know I'm not considering any signal events, and so out here I can measure my fake rates for different kinds of things. Because if I see things here that satisfy all of my other signal requirements, but they don't have enough PT, I could convince myself that here I'm really just measuring how often I'm missing standard model particles.
Okay. So basically, you can measure fake efficiency for photons.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the same is true, by the way, if you're considering other things like muon trident, that the signal is actually quite distinctive kinematically. How am I doing on time?
I mean, you're real cut.
Oh, okay. All right. What have I done? So we've looked at this. Okay. So main results. So now I'm gonna try to convince you that this might be interesting and worth pursuing. So phase one is primarily motivated by the G-2 anomaly that, you know, if you look at other light new particle explanations for how this could be resolved with new physics, those are all ruled out. You have a dark photon, it decays visibly, or it decays invisibly, that's been excluded. But something like mu minus tau hasn't been excluded, or new scalars that might couple to muons but then still decay invisibly. Phase one could get it in this nightmare scenario. This is the last viable way of doing this with stuff that's not, say, part of the MSSM or something at the weak scale. And the plots are cut off at the MeV scale because of Hari's question about BBN and ineffective. And heavier mediators or heavier things that might play a role in resolving muon G-2, you might say are somewhat disfavored because we haven't seen things at the LHC, but that's not a firm statement.
How are you normalizing your G in the
scalar case? In the scalar case, it is the Yukawa coupling of a scalar and two muons.
Okay. So are you content with the bounds coming from, I was just wondering, like, how well we know the branching ratio of, I don't know, for example, Z branching ratio, I guess, would be modified. Mm-hmm. And
yeah, so for these, I mean, so the Z branching ratios we know to like a part in 10 to the 4, right? And that's where these couplings would enter in at quadratic level. So it actually doesn't compete with other things we're seeing. So for this plot, I'm only showing you a simplified model. So don't take the bounds on this too seriously. What I'll show you on the next plot actually has the real model where you do have to take into account other experimental bounds. And the best game in town is actually muon tridents. So So there, because of the high statistics in these things, there's this experiment called CCFR, and what they did was they took a population of neutrinos, muon neutrinos, and they scattered them on nuclear targets, and they looked for dimuon production. Dimuon production is something that you would expect in the standard model just from G Fermi processes. But you could also get it in this model, and you could get an enhancement, because now, depending on what your choice of coupling is, you might just have some anomalous radiation of muons in these events.
And in a lot of your parameter space, you would modify also the branching ratio of chaos, of...
Yeah, but not by a whole lot.
That's not that significant. I think it's like a range of 10 to minus 2 in the GBO.
Okay.
Yeah, actually, so there's a really nice summary of the bounds on different kinds of U1s below the GEV scale. This is a Martin Bauer paper from a couple of weeks ago, where they had a cute title for it. It was like, Hunting All the Hidden Photons. And they considered different reinterpretations of experimental bounds for models like U1, B minus L, mu minus tau, and everything like that. And they took into account all of those kaon things. They were generally at either higher mass or at larger coupling. That the most significant bound will come from neutrino tridents. So I'll show you that on the next slide. You had a question?
I was mostly wondering, I mean, if you do try to include sort of lepton flavor into this story, then you might get other couplings besides muon and tau, right?
That's right, but I think you can live in models where when you generate the neutrino masses, you put the lepton flavor violation in the neutrinos. Or you can still have diagonal couplings to muons and to taus. Yeah.
Okay. Related to that, I mean, this is just the mu minus anything vector, right? So that doesn't, you don't care about it being tau, could be like third generation quarks or something like that.
Right, so you could, for example, do B minus 3 mu. That's one possibility, but then you have to worry about whether other constraints involving proton beams constrain you more. But yeah, this is just one model, so you could play around with this. The technique is sensitive to things that prefer coupling to muons, but it's not exclusive to that.
But it's in whatever current involving muons is an anomaly.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Or even ones that are anomalous and you need new physics, and if you can live in a part of the parameter space that isn't excluded, then yeah.
That's probably ruled out, anyway.
It's probably ruled out, but yeah. I mentioned it for completeness. Yeah, you had a very nice paper about that. Yeah. But the real goal here is to do a search for dark matter and thermal dark matter. And so here what we're showing are different possibilities for your choice of the dark matter particle, and on the y-axis we have a combination of couplings that determines the annihilation rate. So that's the combination that shows up in this diagram. It's written as a dimensionless quantity. There you're also seeing the bounds from CCFR. This is the neutrino trident production and parameter space where you could resolve G minus 2 with a new Z prime. There's just one subtlety about this parameter space. So the choice of the variable on the y-axis is designed so that you don't care too much about the relative sizes of different things that enter into that product, as long as that product is fixed for a given choice of dark matter mass and for a particular choice of dark matter spin, you live along those curves. It's insensitive to say whether or not the dark matter coupling is bigger than the standard model coupling or the other way around. The other bounds, particularly CCFR here, depends a lot on what you assume about the other couplings in the problem, because that one only cares about how the new force couples to muons. That doesn't know anything about dark matter. And so that bound is put on that plot in the most conservative way possible. And so here we've chosen numbers that don't actually look conservative naively, but they're extremely conservative, because if I take G chi to be 1, I'm taking a pretty large choice for how strongly this mediator couples to dark matter. And when I'm fixing everything to give me thermal freeze out, I'm making the weakest possible requirement on the coupling to the standard model. And in that sense, that puts the CCFR exclusion region as high up in the plot as possible. If, on the other hand, we'd chosen a different value for G chi, the constraints move down, but so do the experimental projections, because everything that we assume about our signal also only depends on how the mediator couples to the muon. So those numbers change, those curves move down, but the dark matter relic density regions stay fixed. And so here, for the right choice of parameters, you can do both dark matter and G-2, and these are both within the range of either phase 1 or phase 2. And we also have projections for NA64, which is the CERN version of a muon beam search to look for missing energy at the SPS. Yeah.
What's the reasonable value if you consider self-inductions?
Depends also on your mass ratio. I think that in the lower mass region, if you were around here, the few MeV range, there could be some tension with sigma over m at the centimeter squared per gram level for the coupling of order 1. For this coupling, there's no tension. Once you're at about the few MeV range, even if you make the coupling pretty big, it's not a significant deal. What matters much more is where the delta and effective constraints kick in. Those are not included in this plot because they differ for each of the choices you make about what your dark matter is. They differ at the order 1 level, and so you should mentally insert different vertical curves corresponding to each of the different possibilities sort of at the few MeV range. That's why the plot's cut off on the left. Yeah. Do I have time? How much more?
Yeah, keep going.
Oh, okay, good. So I'll just mention one case study.
Is anybody in this room looking to get bigger about that?
I know Diego has.
Yeah, exactly. Is it a scalar dark matter bug like that?
Sorry?
Scalar mediated dark matter.
You could make a plot like that for scalar mediated, but I think it sort of runs into the same issues that the Higgs portal stuff does. So I'll just say a little bit about the 21 centimeter line, which at face value has nothing to do with this stuff, but there will be a connection at the end. But the basic idea is that when the first stars turn on, they catalyze absorption of Lyman alpha photons in the hydrogen that's left over from recombination. Prior to that, there's a difference between the hydrogen spin temperature and gas temperature. And when this catalyzation takes place by the Voigthausen field effect, which I'm not pronouncing correctly, I'm sure, it equilibrates the gas and spin temperatures, and the standard model predicts the size of an absorption feature in 21 centimeters. There's a 3.8 sigma anomaly. Everyone's heard about this, and it's been interpreted as one possible way of doing interesting things with dark matter. And so if dark matter has a huge cross-section at the 10 to the minus 20 centimeter level, and it's below the GeV scale so that you have a lot of dark matter particles to scatter off of hydrogen and take energy away from it, you can cool the hydrogen down to a point where you can have a larger population of the singlet hyperfine state, so you have more particles that can absorb CMB photons, and so you observe a larger absorption feature. This can be interpreted as dark matter, but it turns out that you have to live in a fairly narrow part of the parameter space. I'm not showing you the other plots, which have way more constraints, but it turns out that if your dark matter is millicharged, then you have a scattering rate that goes like 1 over v to the fourth. That's the ticket for getting a 10 to the minus 20 centimeter squared cross-section. And if the dark matter's abundance fraction is at 1% level, then you can get around constraints from scattering off the CMB, because then you don't have enough of these things to really change the power spectrum. And when you include delta and effective bounds, the same ones that apply to the thermal dark matter story from the earlier slides, you include CMB annihilation bounds and direct constraints from the slack millicharge experiment, there's a region which we've unfortunately colored black where you can explain the edges result. Now, we could ask the question, does this actually give us a complete account for how this sector came about? If you were to postulate a millicharged particle that lived in the region that's viable for edges, you wouldn't actually get a 1% millicharge fraction. You'd get way more dark matter because it lives below that dashed curve that says relic density, which is what you would need in terms of millicharge and mass in order to get a 1% fraction at later times. In order to get both of these things, you have to have additional features in your model, and those additional features will play a role in making sure that you could actually have a model that explains this. If you want it to be predictive and you want to annihilate directly into standard model particles, if you want this to be something like a dark photon where you annihilate directly to electrons and you demand a 1% fraction, then you can just look at where those curves put you in this plot, and it's ruled out by other experiments, and that's hard to weasel out of. Even though it looks like we've chosen very specific numbers to make this work, any other choice that you would make would only make the existing constraints worse. You would, because this is not the particle that's responsible for scattering off the hydrogen. What you would have in this case is that you have a millicharged particle which also has this other force. This force is what's ensuring that you have a 1% fraction, which is why the abundance curves are on this parameter space. And then once you have that, you can ask, where do I have a mass window where I can have a 1% fraction and still be consistent with edges, and that's the blue band. It's an epicycle on top of that, yeah?
Please, but just one thing. You don't have one of them to refer to the hydrogen if you're really charged.
Sorry, not off the hydrogen, off of the protons.
Okay, so
ionized. Yeah, sorry. Yeah. What I mean, you have a 1 over V to the 4th cross section off of baryons, which then leads to a reduction in the hydrogen temperature. Yeah. Thank you. Right, so it's ruled out if you're considering predictive scenarios where the dark matter annihilates directly into standard model particles and those particles happen to be charged. But mu minus tau works, and so you can translate the required parameter space into the mu minus tau scenario. And here, because they're millicharges, we can now demand that they be Dirac particles here. So here we have a Dirac millicharge. If the dark matter is heavier than the muon, then you have some early universe annihilation into charged muons. That's constrained by the CMB power spectrum, because you have out of equilibrium annihilations at late times at EV scale temperatures, which deposit energy into the CMB, and it ionizes hydrogen, so you've got a larger than expected ionized fraction. To the left, you have constraints from delta N effective, from just dumping too much entropy into neutrinos as the dark matter is freezing out. But it turns out that for the 1% fraction that you need, you can do G minus 2 and you can do the 21 centimeter observation. But I stress that this is just a case study to show how the parameters in these plots change, where the sensitivities live, what kinds of scenarios you might be looking for. But there are a lot of constraints once you start deviating away from the 1% region. And so
Why is there no CMB constraint in that 10 MeV to 100 MeV window?
Because here you're annihilating the neutrinos. I'm below the muon threshold. Huh?
Sorry? And below the muon, sure. Oh, I see.
I have nothing else to annihilate. So in principle, there's an induced kinetic mixing from the mu and tau loops. I am getting a 1 part in 10^6 annihilation into electrons. That does contribute, but it isn't ruled out for these choices. Okay, and so I'll just leave it at that. I've already talked a lot, so if people have questions.
You know why, like, M-cube is always 1 over Na64?
So there are two reasons. So one is that Na64 can't really do more than 10^11 muons. So it's luminosity limited, but we've talked to people at Fermilab who think that we can get more, so that's part of the story. The other part of the story is that Na64 is this huge 10-meter experiment. One thing that I didn't emphasize in this is that because we're dealing with lower beam energies, this thing is all sort of few meter scale. At Na64, you're dealing with, you know, several hundred GeV muons, and they need to deflect them a little bit to measure how much energy they've lost, and they end up 10 meters downstream, and they've got like a small little place where they can be observed. So they're not observing every single muon. They're just looking for counts that get deflected off into a very specific region. And so they actually lose a fair bit in acceptance when you get the high masses, where the deflections are a little bit more or a little bit less than what's necessary to enter into that little window. Whereas in our case, we've surrounded the whole interaction point, and we've surrounded the place where we measure the outgoing energy. So we get, in some sense, 2 pi acceptance, whereas they're only getting some small fraction of that. And so that's also why at high masses, we start to get closer and closer to and win over Na64, but that's sort of already in the excluded region.
is the status of the dedicated G minus 2?
Good.
Mm-hmm. How does that compare?
So I want to make a distinction here. So the dedicated G minus 2 experiment is just there to make a standard model measurement. They're just measuring muon G minus 2 and asking whether it agrees with the standard model. That experiment is currently underway, and they should have data in the
Brookhaven statistics by the shutdown, which is, I guess, a few months.
What?
They're trying to get Brookhaven level statistics by the shutdown.
This year.
This year.
Yeah.
And then they would do, you know, the next key.
So that's just a check.
So, yeah, mm-hmm. And then after the shutdown this year, they would take the full statistics, which I forget what ultimately they're trying to do statistics-wise, but it's a couple of years now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so if the central value stays the same, then by the end of their full run, they'll exceed 5 sigma discrepancy levels, and then there'll be more motivation.
The dark matter.
Then we'll detect the dark matter. It's perfect.